This evening we want to pick up there in verse 33 of Matthew 5. We want to notice two other areas where Jesus says that our righteousness needs to excel. And that it's in these, and that is in the areas rather of honesty, especially when it comes to the matter of taking oaths, and then also responding to evil or going the second mile. And again, Jesus says that our righteousness needs to exceed, the scribes and Pharisees needs to excel in these areas. Our text will be taken from Matthew 5, verses 33 through 42. So let's go ahead and read all those verses, and then we'll kind of take these in two parts here. Matthew 5, beginning with verse 33. Jesus says, "Again, you have heard that it was said of those of old, 'You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord.' But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one. You have heard that it was said, 'An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth.' But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away." Well, as we said, Jesus has been showing his listeners that he expects a higher standard of his disciples than they were used to seeing from the so-called religious people of their day, namely the scribes and the Pharisees. And the standard that he first discusses in the verses that we just read involves our honesty. Are you a man or woman of your word? Am I a man of my word? When you say yes or no, do people take it as truth? Or are you and I someone whose word is questioned unless it's confirmed with an oath? We want to see what Jesus taught on this matter. And in doing so, we want to consider four questions. First of all, what did the law of Moses actually teach concerning the swearing of oaths? Secondly, how had the Jews, specifically the scribes and the Pharisees, traditionally interpreted and applied the law in this matter? Thirdly, what did Jesus teach in response to this abuse of the law concerning oaths? And then finally, did Jesus forbid oaths altogether, including maybe even those that are made or taken in a court of law? Well, to answer the first question, let's take a moment to consider what the law of Moses had to say about the swearing of oaths. There are three passages that I want to notice with you that I think make very clear the teaching of the law. First of all, in Leviticus 19 and verse 12, it says, "And you shall not swear by my name falsely, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." Also in Numbers 30 and verse 2, it reads, "If a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." And finally, in Deuteronomy 23 and verse 21, we find there, "When you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and it will be sin to you." In all these passages, the emphasis is not taking vows or not making oaths. The emphasis is on sticking to those oaths and sticking to those vows, our truthfulness and our faithfulness. A person must be truthful when he swears an oath. He must truly mean it. He must also be faithful in keeping the oath. That means he must carry out his word. So the emphasis here on truthfulness, the emphasis on truthfulness in the heart was also stressed by the Psalms and by the prophets. For example, in Psalm 15, verses 1 and 2, we read, "Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? He who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart." Also, Psalm 24, verses 3 and 4 say, "Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who may stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul to an idol, nor sworn deceitfully." As I said, the prophets also spoke of this, and they often sadly mourned the lack of truth in the heart of God's people. For example, Jeremiah says in Jeremiah 5, verses 1 and 2, "Run to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem. See now and know, and seek in her open places, if you can find a man, if there is anyone who executes judgment, who seeks the truth, and I will pardon her. Though they say, as the Lord lives, surely they swear falsely." Sad words there, certainly. And then also in Hosea 4, verses 1 and 2, the prophet there writes, "Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel. For the Lord brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying, killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break all restraint with bloodshed upon bloodshed." And so again, the teaching of the law was very clear that vows should be kept. Truthfulness in all things was expected. As we can see, that was not always the case with God's people, sadly. Well, that leads to our second question. How had the Jews, and in particular the scribes and Pharisees, traditionally interpreted, and more importantly, how had they applied what the law had to say about oaths and truthfulness? Well, it appears that the emphasis had shifted. Again, God's law had always stressed truthfulness in all things. But now it seems that they were focused only on honoring vows that were sworn to the Lord. And it seems they made a big deal out of the wording of their oaths and the wording of their vows. And I think this is implied by Jesus' comments there in verses 34 and 36 of our text. We can see that the Jews had made arbitrary distinctions, if you will, between their vows. Again, stressing those that were made to the Lord and maybe not so much those that were made otherwise. And so Jesus says, "Don't swear by heaven or earth or Jerusalem or your head. Don't make any of these oaths if you're not going to keep them." Again, I think we can see this in his teachings in Matthew 23, verses 16 through 19. He says there, "Woe to you, blind guides, who say, 'Whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it.' Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar," they're saying this, or he's saying that they say this, "whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obliged to perform it." Again, Jesus said, "Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift?" And so again, we can see that the Jews were making these distinctions between their oaths, and their daily conversations, it seems, were often spiced up with meaningless oaths that were meant just to make an impression. They would say things like, "I swear by heaven," or "I swear by the throne of God," or "I swear by the earth," or "by Jerusalem," or "by the altar," or "by the temple," or "by my head," and so on. And according to their logic, since these oaths weren't made to the Lord, then they didn't necessarily have to be kept. In other words, these were just meaningless vows, at least by their reasoning. Well, that leads to our third question. What did Jesus teach in response to their abuse of the law concerning oaths? Well, he exposed their hypocrisy in making such arbitrary distinctions between their oaths. Matthew 23, verses 20 and 22 clearly shows when one swears by the temple or by the throne of God, he is still swearing by the Lord. Again, Jesus says, "Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it." Well, likewise in our text, verses 34 and 36, Jesus teaches that a person cannot swear by these things without involving God. Heaven is the throne of God. Earth is his footstool. Even man's own head is the creation of God and is under his control. And so to swear by it is to acknowledge God's presence and God's power. In short, any oath is an oath to the Lord. But Jesus went further than just explaining the old law. As Brother Nate has pointed out throughout our study, Jesus' sermon here, Sermon on the Mount, not only explained the old law and often corrected some of the misinterpretations and misapplications that the Jews were guilty of making, but he was also, in essence, introducing his own law, a new law, which often took things a step further to a new level of excellence and expectation. Jesus says in verse 37, "But let your yes be yes, and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one. Again, I think Jesus' point here is to stress and emphasize the importance of truthfulness. He says that his disciples have to be true to their word. So true to their word that they don't have to require oaths. They shouldn't require an oath to let it be known that they're speaking the truth. In other words, when a disciple of Christ says something, it should be taken for the truth. Just a simple yes or no is enough to let everyone know where they stand and what they intend to do. They don't have to back it up with any type of oath. As we read in Psalm 15 and 2, the one who speaks the truth in his heart is the one who abides with the Lord. Well, in exposing this hypocrisy of the scribes and the Pharisees in their oaths and commanding us to speak simply and truthfully, this has led many to ask our fourth question. Did Jesus actually forbid oaths altogether? Did Jesus say that it is unlawful for us to swear or to make an oath or to make a promise even, if you will? What about in a court of law? Is it wrong to say, I swear? Well, I suppose if we take Jesus' words here in verse 34 alone and maybe even out of context, he does plainly say, do not swear at all. And as I said, many have taken these words to mean just that, that we must not say the phrase, I swear. And I have to admit, I hesitate to use those words. That word, at least, is not one that is in my everyday vocabulary. At least I hope it's not. But not only because of Jesus' teaching here, also because of the seriousness of such an oath. You know, we don't really know the future. Sometimes circumstances change and make us wish that we had not made promises that now are difficult to keep. That's not to say that we ever have reason to not keep our word. If we have made a promise, then we are to keep it. In fact, that's the whole point, again, of Jesus' teaching here. But what I mean is, instead of promising or swearing, I prefer to say I intend to do something because we simply don't know what the future holds. In fact, I'm even hesitant to say I swear about something that's already happened or that I believe has already happened because knowing my memory, there's a good chance I just don't remember how it happened correctly or exactly how it happened. In seriousness, though, we need to take a closer look at what Jesus is saying. I believe that Jesus actually qualified his statement here concerning oaths. He says, do not swear at all, but then that's immediately qualified by his reference to these flippant and hypocritical oaths that were commonly voiced by the people, such as, I swear by heaven, or I swear by my head, and so on. A similar statement is made by the Apostle James in James 5 and verse 12. He says there, but above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment. James 2 qualifies his command not to swear by referring to the same kind of meaningless oaths that these Jews were guilty of. Besides the qualifications here with both Jesus's and James's statements, though, I also think we should consider the following when we ask whether or not Jesus forbids us to make oaths. First of all, God has sworn an oath to us. He swore an oath to Abraham, and he has to us, according to Hebrews 6, verses 13 through 18. We also find that Jesus was willing to answer under oath before the high priest, according to Matthew 26, verses 63 through 64. Paul made solemn oaths in his epistles, in 2 Corinthians 1 and 23, also Galatians 1 and 20, and other places as well. And then John saw an angel of God swear an oath in Revelation 10, verses 5 through 7. And so if Jesus has forbidden oaths altogether, then how can we explain these instances here? As I said, there are some who as a matter of conscience, just refuse to say, I swear, under any circumstances, even in a court of law. And I think that's perfectly okay. Again, if your conscience, that goes against your conscience, then you certainly should not say that. And thankfully, our country has allowed them to say phrases such as, I affirm, or other things, instead of, I swear. As I said, I think that's perfectly okay. But I do wonder, though, what the real difference in saying, I swear, or I affirm, really is. Especially if we raise our hand or place our hand on a Bible as if to make it official, I'm not sure there's much difference in the two. They are both oaths, they are both vows and promises to tell the truth. And speaking of vows, what about wedding vows? When the preacher says, "Do you, John, promise to love and cherish and so forth?" And John says, "I do," isn't that an oath? In fact, isn't it an oath before God and before witnesses, and then it's signed into a legally binding court document? To me, that's a very serious oath. And so my point is this: whether your conscience allows you to use the word swear or not, as I said, I prefer not to use that phrase myself. But I think whether you use that particular phrase or not, Jesus' teaching still applies. And that is, we must avoid making any type of flippant or profane or hypocritical oaths or promises or vows of any kind. We should never swear or promise just to make an impression or just to spice up our conversation. And we should especially never make an oath that we do not intend to keep. Christians are to be so truthful that it's not necessary for them to swear oaths or even have to say, "I promise," in order to be trusted. As Jesus said in verse 37, anything else but the truth comes from the evil one. Of course, we know he's speaking of the devil, who, by the way, is called the father of lies, according to John 8 and verse 44. Well, on to the second half of our study tonight. Continuing on the same train of thought, that is, how our righteousness should exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees, Jesus continues his sermon in verses 38 through 42 with what is probably one of his most famous sayings, but it may also be one of the most difficult to live up to and to follow. It's this idea of a second-mile religion. Again, he says in verses 38 through 42, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away." How do you respond when someone treats you wrong? Do you give them back a taste of their own medicine, so to speak? Do you treat evil or return evil with evil? Or do you just stand there and take whatever abuse is given? What is the proper way to respond to evil? Well, just as we did with the first idea in our lesson, let's compare what the law of Moses really taught with how the Jews, and again, in particular, the scribes and the Pharisees, how they had traditionally interpreted and applied the law. This concept of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is found in Exodus 21, verses 24 through 25. The Lord there is giving laws to guide the priests in sentencing or giving out proper punishment. And specifically, this law was applied to an occasion where men were fighting and inadvertently or accidentally harmed a pregnant woman and caused her to give birth prematurely. And Moses said there, or God told Moses to say, if no one was harmed, then the guilty party would be punished as the woman's husband determined, and also would have to pay as the judges saw fit. But if any harm was done, in other words, if the baby was harmed, or perhaps if the mother was harmed, then the punishment was to match whatever the injury might be. A life, if someone was killed, for a life. An eye, if someone lost their eye, for an eye. A tooth for a tooth. A hand for a hand. A foot for a foot. A burn for a burn. A wound for a wound. A stripe for a stripe, Moses details there. Similar guidelines were declared for false witnesses, for punishing false witnesses in Deuteronomy 19 and 21, and also for a man who disfigured his neighbor in Leviticus 24 and 20. And so the point is that these laws, or these parts of the old law, they were meant for courts. They were meant to help the priests know what punishments to hand out in a court. However, the scribes and the Pharisees had reinterpreted these statements, or misinterpreted, really, we should say, and they had used them to justify their own personal judgment, their own personal retribution. Instead of applying them only to the courts and only to the priests, they misapplied them by frequently and often taking matters into their own hands and laying out or doling out personal revenge. Of course, we know that many people feel the same way today. But the fact is, the law prohibited revenge, prohibited vengeance. In Leviticus 19 and verse 18, for example, it says, "You shall not take vengeance." Proverbs 20 and 22 says, "Do not say, I will recompense evil." Proverbs 24, 29 says, "Do not say, I will do to him just as he has done to me." You see, in both the Old Testaments and the New Testaments, this matter of revenge or vengeance was to be left up to God and to those that God had appointed, had given the authority to hand out these judgments or to hand out these punishments. Personal vengeance and revenge has no place in the lives of the children of God. And so what then is the proper response to evil? How should we respond to someone who does us wrong? Well, Jesus really didn't leave us to wonder. He didn't tell us just not what not to do. He didn't tell us, well, don't get revenge and then not leave us with anything that we are to do. In fact, he gave us very clear instructions on what to do. And what he said to do probably goes against everything that the Jews of his day, those who were listening, had always presumed, and really against everything that most of our world today would teach us as well. And that is to respond to evil by doing good. Jesus then illustrates this principle with several examples. First of all, he offers what we should do in response to physical abuse. And his example is getting slapped on the face, on the right cheek. He says, if you get slapped on the right cheek, just turn the other cheek. Again, Jesus is speaking here of physical abuse, but it's really more than that. It's really a loss of honor, someone who has dishonored you. Slapping someone in the face is something that's open to public view. It's very aggressive, very deliberate, and it's meant to embarrass or to humiliate the other person. In fact, in our modern language, when we describe something that's humiliating, we say, well, that's a slap in the face. Not literally, but we know what that means. But Jesus says if someone slaps you, instead of retaliating, instead of getting revenge, turn the other cheek. As always, Jesus left the perfect example of how to do this. Isaiah 50 verse 6 says it very well. Speaking of Jesus there, it says, I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting. You see, when Jesus was slapped and spit upon and mocked, he did not retaliate. In fact, instead, he prayed for their forgiveness, those who were treating him in this way. And so we are to follow Jesus' example when it comes to being dishonored or being physically attacked. Secondly, Jesus offers how to respond to a civil suit when we are sued in a court of law. He says, if someone sues you to take away your coat, give him your cloak also. Give them more than what they're suing you for. Again, that certainly must have gone against everything that the Jews had presumed and what most of our world presumes as well. It sounds crazy in our way of thinking to give them more than they're trying to sue me for. That probably, as I said, would have sounded crazy to Jesus' listeners as well. In fact, if we dig a little deeper into what he's saying here, I read that most commoners, most common people, only had one cloak, which would be an outer garment made to really keep you warm. Most people just had one. But yet, here Jesus was suggesting that they be willing to give it up, even when they weren't necessarily even asked for it. Well, then thirdly, Jesus gives us an example of how to respond to government oppression, to those who are in authority over us. He says, if someone compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Go the second mile. In other words, volunteer to do more than what is being demanded of you. And again, if we kind of dig into the historical background of this, I think it really makes it come to life. You've probably heard me give this illustration before, but the word compel that Jesus uses here, or that's used at least in the King James Version, in the New King James Version, it basically means to force. And so Jesus is saying when someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them too. You may remember that Simon of Cyrene, he was compelled or forced to carry the cross of Jesus to Golgotha. And so Jesus again says, if someone forces you to go 1 mile. Now again, historically this expression refers to the authority that was given by the king to those who he sent to do his bidding. If the people who the king sent out to do whatever task it was, if they needed help in fulfilling this mission, then they could basically force or commandeer any man or horse or wagon with no questions asked. The Greeks and the Romans and their powerful armies, they had adopted this practice. In fact, the Romans, who were, of course, in control during Jesus' day, they had gone so far as to specify in their law that a Roman soldier could force any Jewish citizen to carry his pack, which was no light load, to carry his pack for 1 mile. This was meant to relieve the soldier on long journeys, of course, but as you can imagine, it was not only an inconvenience, but it was a disgrace to the Jews. Imagine going about your business. Maybe you're on your way to work. Maybe you're even on your way to worship. And all of a sudden, you hear someone yell, "Hey, you. Yeah, you, come here. Carry this pack for me." You know, this strapping, strong soldier may not even look like he needs your help. He may not be going in the direction that you're headed. But you had no choice. You had to drop what you were doing, pick up his pack, and carry it for him for 1 mile. Now, certainly, it would be one thing to be asked to do such a favor by a friend or by a family member, but to be forced to do so by someone that you considered your enemy, well, certainly that must have been another story. And the Jews deeply resented this humiliating law. They saw it as a symbol of domination over them by the Romans. It's interesting. History tells us that a mile, at least a Roman mile, was equal to about 1,000 steps or 1,000 paces. And so you can imagine as a Jewish man being forced to carry this Roman soldier's pack grudgingly and reluctantly, you can imagine that they must have counted every step along the way. 997, 998, 999, and as soon as you got to 1,000, drop it, that's it, I'm done, I'm not going a step further. I've done all that I'm being forced to do. And then Jesus comes along and says, you know what? If he asks you or even forces you to go a mile, go ahead and go 2 miles instead. Instead of telling them to resist this law, which by all accounts was unjust, instead of telling them, okay, obey the law since it's a law, but do the bare minimum that's required of you, Jesus calls upon his followers to respond to evil with good, to voluntarily offer to serve this person a second mile. And then fourthly, Jesus illustrates how to respond to those who are asking for our help. And he says to give them what they ask. In each case, the principle is the same. We're not to resist the person who would mistreat us or who would try to deprive us of our possessions. Instead, we are to respond in a positive manner, to demonstrate our love towards them, and to do so by freely giving them more than they were hoping to gain, whether by force or by oppression, or by manipulation, or just by asking. Now, the obvious question, I'm sure, is this. Are we to take all of this literally? Does Jesus really expect us to do these things, to let someone slap us around, to give away more than we're being sued for or that we're being asked for, to do more than we're required by law to do? The answer is, if not, why not? Why do we not take Jesus' words literally? You know, we have several Old Testament examples of men of God that did just this. Joseph in forgiving his brothers in Genesis 45. David in sparing the life of Saul, even though Saul would not have done the same for him. Elisha in feeding the armies of the enemy. We also have several New Testament examples. Probably one that comes to mind is Stephen, as he was being stoned to death, actually prayed for those who were taking his life. The Hebrew Christians in Hebrews 10, it says that they joyfully accepted the plundering of their goods. And then, of course, the best example of all, our prime example, is Jesus. Peter described how Jesus gives us an example of this very well. In 1 Peter 2, verses 21 through 23, he says, "For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously." We also have the teachings of the Apostle Paul in Romans 12, verses 19 through 21. He says there, "Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." And that's really the lesson that Jesus is trying to get across here, to respond to evil with good. If the words of Jesus and if the words of Paul, if we are not to take those literally, then how else can we apply them? What else do they mean? The teachings of Jesus in this passage admittedly are challenging. As we've said, it goes against everything that our society teaches. It goes against maybe even what we might call human nature. But after all, the Bible teaches us that we are to fight that human nature, and instead we are to be partakers of the divine nature, according to 2 Peter 1 and verse 4. In other words, we are to be more like God than we are like men anyway. You know, we may never face the exact situations that Jesus uses to illustrate his point here. We may never be slapped in the face. We may never be forced to walk a mile. But the principle certainly can be applied to so many things that we do face. How people treat us at work, in our communities, maybe even in our own families, or maybe even in the church. And so again, Jesus' point is, whenever we're mistreated, we need to take his challenge to see how we might overcome evil with good. Well, in conclusion tonight, as we've already mentioned, the main reason that we should want to practice doing these things is because Jesus did this for you and for me and so much more, so that we could have forgiveness of our sins. If you're here this evening and you've never received that forgiveness, then certainly we encourage you to obey the gospel today. Through belief, repentance, confession, and baptism, you can be forgiven of your sins. You can take advantage of Jesus' sacrifice for you. Or if you've once obeyed these steps but you have not remained faithful, then certainly we encourage you to return to him today through repentance, confession, and prayer. We can assist anyone in any way. Please let us know while we stand and while we sing.